In this lecture, I'm going to derive the path integral for the quantum mechanical propagator. And a lot of what I'm going to do is based on a set of lecture notes by a guy called Richard McKenzie. And these are really beautiful lecture notes. And if path integrals is something that you're not really quite comfortable with or you haven't seen it before, I would really recommend getting a copy of these notes. So he goes into quite a, you know, he goes a lot further into what we're going to cover in this lecture, but they're just very nice and clean and easy to follow. So I'll give you a reference to these notes as well. You can find them on the archive. Is there anyone here that doesn't know what the archive is? Okay, very good. Okay. Yeah, so for those of you that just came in, I'm saying that we're going to be talking about the path integral. I'll be deriving the path integral for the quantum mechanical propagator, and I'm basing this off a set of lecture notes by Richard McKenzie. And so I just really recommend everybody going to have a look at these notes because they go into a lot more than I'm going to cover in this lecture. So you can find them on the archive here. Okay, great. So just a little bit of background. So in the 1920s, Schrödinger and Heisenberg and a bunch of other people developed the standard formulation of quantum mechanics. And then in 1933, Dirac was thinking a bit about this, and he pointed out that the action plays a central role in classical mechanics, but it doesn't seem to, you know, have any role in quantum mechanics. And in order to try and, you know, find a solution to this, he suggested that the quantum mechanical propagator should correspond to e to the I s on h bar, where s is the classical action. And so then later on in 1948, Feynman actually further developed Dirac's suggestion, and he derived a third formulation of quantum mechanics. And so in this formulation, the propagator is actually the sum of all possible paths, not just the classical path, but all possible paths that a particle can take from point A to point B. So in deriving path integral for the propagator, we're going to just begin with a single particle moving in one dimension. So, we have a single particle, and the Hamiltonian is going to be of the familiar form p squared on 2m plus a potential v of x. Or v of q. And so the question that we want to answer is, if the particle starts off at position q at time t, what's the probability amplitude that it's going to be at some other position, q prime, at a time t equals capital T? So quantum mechanically, we can say that the amplitude is going to be given by the following expression. And in these notes, we're going to have h bar set to 1 until a little bit later on. And so what we can see here is that it's just the overlap between a particle that starts at position q, evolves according to the Hamiltonian for some time capital T, and then we're going to see what the overlap is between that final state and the state that we're interested in at position q prime. And so this is what we define as the propagator. And so we say that's the propagator that takes you from position q at time 0 to position q prime at time capital T.
Mm-hmm. So you're working in natural units, or?
H bar is equal to 1.
H bars, yeah.
Yep. So we'll, at the end, we'll put H bar back in using dimensional analysis, yeah. Okay, so then the process that we're going to follow is to split up this evolution into different parts. So we can first start off just by splitting it up into an evolution over time, what are we calling it, T1, and then an evolution over, you know, the remaining time. So we can say that this is equal to Q prime e to the I H capital T minus T1, and then e to the I HT1 on Q. And so first we evolve from 0 to T1, and then from T1 to capital T. And then we do like a very nice thing, which is insert the resolution of identity in the position basis. And so we can rewrite this as so this here is just equal to the identity. And then if we move things around a little bit, we can bring this integral out the front because it's over Q1. And we can rewrite this as where the propagator here is defined in the same way as we have here. And so what we can see is happening is that first we have a propagator that takes you from time 0 position q to time 1 position q1, and then takes you from position q1 to the final position q prime. However, we don't really know what q1 is. It could be any position, you know, anywhere in space, so we're going to then sum over all of these intermediate positions q1. Okay, so we've done this once, that was easy. And then we can repeat this process many times by splitting up the, instead of splitting up the evolution into just two sections, we can split it up into big N sections, and then have each section propagate you over a period of time, delta T, or just delta. So let's write that down. So if we do this, we can write the propagator as q prime, then evolution over time delta, and we do this n times, and then our initial position q. And so if we want to write this out explicitly, it'll look something like this. And so now what we're going to do is, again, insert the resolution of identity, but we'll do this many times in between each of these evolutions by a very short amount of time. Okay, I'm just going to write this out. It's going to take a little while, but it doesn't hurt to see it. So here we've got one resolution of identity, then we put in another one. Another one all the way down to Q1. And notice here that I've now redefined, not yet. Okay, we're still okay here. So I've just inserted the resolution of identity. Each one of these guys is one. And as we did in this step, we can rewrite it in terms of a bunch of propagators. So now we have many integrals over different positions q, ranging all the way from q1 to qn minus 1. And then we can write down our propagators for each individual time segment. Okay, and here I've redefined things. So I've now said that q prime is equal to qn, and the initial q I'm now labeling q0. And so notice that this integral is over all of the intermediate positions, but it's not over the final and initial positions because these are fixed. So let's just say q0 is defined as q and qn is defined as q prime. And I've also just rewritten how I'm labeling the propagator, because here we were specifying particular times, but here each of these propagators is like for the same time interval delta, so I'm not rewriting it. But I can write down the definition anyway. Like that. Okay, so we can see here that we've got a whole bunch of propagators. We're integrating over all of the intermediate paths. And just to give you a little bit more intuition for what's going on, I want to draw this schematically. So here we have our one-dimensional position q, and here we have time. And I'll just split this up into little time intervals. So we go from 0 delta, 2 delta, 3 delta, and then n minus 2 delta, n minus 1 delta, and all the way out to t. So let's say our particle starts at position q0, and then it's going to take a whole bunch of different paths up to q1, and then, was there a hand? No, okay. And you know, kind of go crazy. Q2, Q3, you know, all the way up till the end. And then it has to end up at the final position, Qn. And so then the path integral is going to be the sum over all of these possible paths. And so apart from the mathematical details of taking, you know, the limit where n goes to infinity, you can see that this is clearly going to be something like k is equal to a sum over paths for the amplitude for each path, where we can define, so sum over paths is equal to this integral that we have. And a particular path will be given by the product of the propagators. Yeah, so at this point in time, we're assuming that the Hamiltonian commutes itself commutes with itself at different times. If we didn't, we would need to be we would need like an integral in the exponential.
Right.
Yep. Okay, great. So we've got something that depends on a product of all of these propagators. And so let's just look at one of the propagators for one of these tiny little time intervals. So let's consider the last term in that expression. Okay, and because we've already made the assumption that delta is going to be a very small time interval, we can just do a Taylor expansion around, looks like zero. So qj plus one, and then we expand the exponential. And if we now act these bras and kits onto the terms inside the brackets, we can see so we have one term that's just the inner product of qj minus 1 and q, this should be qj, right? Yeah. And then we have a term with the Hamiltonian sandwiched between these two bras and kits, and then everything else is of order delta squared or higher. And so let's first look at this term. This is just a delta function because the inner product of two position a bra and a cat is going to give you a delta function. So one is and we can rewrite this in terms of an integral over momentum. Give me one sec. Q plus 1. Yep. Excellent. Thank you very much. Okay, so you can see that this is true because this is just a Fourier transform of a constant. So a Fourier transform of something that's constant is going to give you a delta function in the variable, in the exponential. So that's nice. We're going to use that later. And for the second bit, for the second term, okay, we're going to play our favorite game, which is insert the resolution of identity. So we can write minus I delta qj plus 1. I'm putting in the expression for the Hamiltonian that we had at the beginning. So this thing here is our resolution of identity. And now, so, I mean, the way that I wrote down the Hamiltonian at the beginning, I didn't put hats on it, but it was implied that these are all operators. So here I've explicitly put all the hats on the operators. And now what we'd like to do is just to act these operators on the bras and kits. And so we just choose the ones that make our lives easier. So the P operator is going to act in this direction on the momentum eigenstate, and the Q operator is going to act in this direction on the position one. So we can say that this is now equal to I delta integral over PJ. And then we have a few inner products. And then we can make use of the fact that, that the inner product between Q and P is given by e to the I PQ. So I'll just rewrite these two inner products using that. Okay, so one thing we should notice is like this expression is kind of asymmetric in terms of some things depending on Qj plus one and some things depending on Qj plus one and Qj. And it would have looked different if we put this identity in on the left-hand side of the Hamiltonian. I mean, like you can make one choice or the other. And the way that people usually reconcile this is to take both solutions and then take the average over the Q that you would get for one solution and the Q that you would get for the other solution. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm probably being sloppy with well, because I'm not integrating over J, I'm integrating over PJ, so it doesn't like affect the QJ. Okay, so yeah, if we stuck in this integral here or here, we would have when we evaluated this Q act, it now would have acted, in this direction rather in that direction. And then you'd get an expression that had a VQJ here. And so yeah, the way people just do something which is a little bit like weird, but it's typical to do it, but they just take the average of both solutions. So they just define something called QJ is equal to QJ plus QJ plus one on two. But it really doesn't matter because in the end you're just going to take the continuum limit. So whether you like take this definition or whether you do something else, like in the end it'll just mathematicians stop looking at me. It's what?
Analogous to gravity of motion, like in the sort of wave rotation, the Euclidean field theory, you're just doing gravity of motion. But this is actually like an important subtle point, whether you take one endpoint or the other endpoint when you define like integrals. This is it's not something you kind of just like
Yeah, so
it's important that
I believe you that it's important and it probably is many lectures to go through it. So we're just sketching out the solution. And I mean, admittedly, I'm not a mathematician and I
Yeah,
don't.
well,
Yeah.
also in Lorentz signature, none of this is really can be done that carefully, so I wouldn't.
But in any case, I mean, I think
Yeah,
if you.
Yeah.
I mean, like we know that the solution is correct, and I guess like each step here is plausible if you're not being meticulous mathematically. So I think it's still worthwhile going through it. Yeah,
Definitely, no,
yeah,
this
yeah,
is not.
So unless you're being uber pedantic, this won't matter when you take the limit to where n goes to infinity. Yes, Ben.
I have a simpler question.
Sure.
Just when you move the QJ plus one from the left of the Hamiltonian to the right, I think I understand what's going on, but just to clarify, the reason that the V is QJ plus one is because that Q operator is acting on
Right.
that.
Yeah, so I mean the
You have
Q.
to worry about commuting that Q with the P squared.
Right, so this is the thing, right? You don't. Okay, no. So there, it's a sum, so you don't have to worry about them commuting. Like if you expanded this out, you would have two different terms, one term that depended on Q and one term that depended on P. So one term that had an operator that was P and one term that had an operator that depended on Q. But even when you have both of those terms, you don't really want to be acting the operator Q in this direction because you've got these, I mean, this operator PJ here. So the Q operator is going to act in this direction because it's just sitting nicely next to this eigenstate. Do you want, I can write this out explicitly if you want, in the two terms, if that'll help.
But I don't want to waste everybody else's time, maybe.
But I mean, like you could totally do it. It's just expand. I mean, so the two terms will be this times that plus this times that. So when you have a sum of two operators, you don't worry about them commuting. It's only when you have products of operators. Okay. But we can also talk about it in the tutorial if you haven't figured it out by then. But in any case, because we put in this Q, sorry, this I on this side, we're acting Q to the left. But if instead we put this identity on this side, then we'd have a bunch of P bras and kets that were kind of interfering with our Q acting in that direction. So then Q would be sitting right next to that Q, and we would act it in that direction. So you'd get like two different solutions. And so this is that people resolve it by just taking a, you know, an average of both solutions. Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to combine this term here and this term here to just write down the propagator. So, okay, so in both cases, we see that we have a term that looks like this. Is that obvious? Oh, yeah, we have this term here, and also we have, hang on a sec, let me just make sure that's okay. Yeah, so we have, sorry, I thought these were operators and I got confused. And then we have something that's the integral over pj and that term here, so we can bring that out the front. And then from the first term, we just get a 1. And then from the second term, we have something that looks like that. And now we're using this average q that we defined down there. And then we've got things of order d squared. Okay, and now we can see that this essentially looks like, at least to first order, it looks like I've expanded an exponential, so I'm going to now turn this back into an exponential. So at least to first order, this looks like a product of two exponentials. And I've now just written in the Hamiltonian as H, where before we had it written in explicitly.
That is exact.
Yeah, it's exact because you've got this thing here.
All right. If you expand it to like larger orders, surely you can be pretty much the same.
Well, if this really meant that it was the higher order terms of the expansion, then it would be okay. But these could be like arbitrary second order terms.
Oh, so you can't
just do the same thing. So if you go in one direction, it's okay. So at this stage, like you could go back and it would be exact, but somewhere along the line, I've lumped other things into what second order means.
Right.
And so. Sorry, if I had a what?
Like the thing you had on top of the start of the
Oh, yeah. If there was a square here. Right, exactly. And then it wouldn't, like after you act all the operators on the bras and kets, it wouldn't necessarily be the exact form of an exponential. Okay. Right, so we have an expression for just this one term here, but we know we're going to have a product of n of these. And then we're going to integrate over all of the different positions. So let's first just write down the expression for what I'm calling the amplitude for a particular path. So that's going to be a product. A product of integrals over dp. So let's just see if that makes sense. Okay, right. So we've got a product of all of these terms. So this product here is just talking about having a product of dpjs. And then we have a product of everything in here. So I've now put the arguments of the exponentials just in terms of one exponential. So it's this thing plus that thing. And when you have a product outside of an exponential, you can turn that into a sum inside the argument of the exponential. So now we have an exponential with a sum over these terms and over the Hamiltonian. And I've also defined the q dot to be the time difference of, the difference in from one position to the next divided by the time interval. So I don't know if I want to say that explicitly. And I'm ignoring ignoring the multiplicative factor of 1 plus order d squared to the power of n, because that's just going to go to 1 when I take the limit where n equals where n goes to infinity. Okay, and now we can write down the entire propagator, which is going to be a sum over all of the intermediate positions. And then this big exponential with the sum inside. Okay, so now I've written a product over the integrals over qj, a product over the integrals over pj, and then our sum. And so one thing to notice is that there are n integrals for momentum, because it goes from j0 to n minus 1. And there are n minus 1 integrals for the position. So if we look at our picture again, that might make sense. Yes, what's up?
You got 3, like, you used the same index 3 times for the...
Yeah, okay. Can I do that? Yeah, so when I was looking through this, like, it was bothering me, and I wanted to, like, give them different labels. And then that caused me problems later on. So I'm just doing exactly what Richard did. But it's okay, right? Like, as long as that J refers to everything in that bracket, that's fine.
But there are J's outside the brackets. Yeah.
But that's okay, because, like, they refer to that J.
Oh, okay. But then exactly all you refer to is, like, a constant, right?
It's a what?
Like, yeah, you know, the point is that there's nothing, if the only j's are inside the brackets, integral is a constant. And it's the integral of dqj is just qj from
no,
j.
Just, no, because no, like this means. Right. So, like, you're not. Like, when you do the integral, you're going to do the integral over each one of these guys. So, like, after you've expanded this thing out, then, like, you'll only have, like, ones and twos and threes.
Okay.
And then those ones and twos and threes will correspond to the ones and twos and threes in there. I think it's okay. So, yes.
Is there a bar on the last Q?
Yeah. Thank you, Morten. Okay. Oh yeah, so I just wanted to have a... Sorry? The second product is multiple.
Oh right,
yeah, that's a P. But it's awesome that you guys are checking all of this. It means you're paying attention. Right, okay, so yeah, the thing that I was pointing out was that there are n integrals over momentum. So that makes sense because momentum is talking about stuff that's happening between these intervals. So you're going to have n of these. Position is talking about like what's happening at each one of these positions. So really, there would be n plus 1, but we're not integrating over the initial and the final one. So really, we have n minus 1 integrals. So that's just, I'm just pointing this out because like maybe at some stage in the future, potentially in an interview, you may be asked to write down the propagator for something, and you might like not remember what, you know, what these limits should be. But if you, you know, reason it that way, you'll be able to remember like that, you know, 1 goes from 0, 1 goes to from 1. Okay. Yeah, when I say interview, I don't mean job interview. I mean like the interviews we have at the end of the courses, right? Sorry. Yeah, I doubt anyone's going to ask you that in a job interview. Okay, how are we going for time? Kind of okay. So what did I want to say? Okay, and we can write this down in shorthand. Using this funny notation. Okay, just so you can see it. And so that result is what's known as the phase space path integral. And so you can think of this as an integral over all paths P of t, all functions P of t, and all functions Q of t. And I've taken the limit where n goes to infinity so that the sum became an integral from 0 to capital T. So that's a nice shorthand way of writing it down. But in practice, if you like ever actually want to evaluate this, you're going to have to take this to mean the expression that we have above it as in the limit where n goes to infinity. It's totally just the action, yeah. Very good. Okay, great. And so I'm just going to take this one step further. I'm not going to have a chance to cover everything that I wanted, so maybe some of this is going to leak over into tomorrow's lecture, but that's okay. Yeah, we can take this a little bit further because we can evaluate some of these integrals. So let's take the form of the Hamiltonian for a single particle in 1D. God, there's a lot of writing in this lecture. It's crazy. Okay, so what have I done here? I've taken that expression for k and inserted the Hamiltonian, and then I moved things around a little bit. So let's make sure all the brackets are okay. And so I've moved all of the things that depend on Q on this side, and then left all of the things that depend on P inside the integral for P. And just so we don't get confused with like the J's again, these J's refer to those, these ones refer to those, and so on. Okay, so now we're coming to the point where I actually want to use that Gaussian integral that I wrote down, and it's not even anywhere. Where was it? Okay, cool. Okay, great. So now we have a whole bunch of Gaussian integrals for the momentum variable, and they're all uncoupled. So like it's just a product of individual Gaussian integrals, and we can use that expression to evaluate that. And so we will have the following. And so then our propagator becomes this. Do you know if we can move them incrementally? Or have you guys seen that done? Mm-hmm. I'm scared it's going to go all the way up. Actually, I'll just kneel. It doesn't matter. Okay. Okay, so here I've just used that result for the momentum integral. And okay, yeah, then it's just a matter of rearranging things, but let me double check. Oh yeah, okay, so we have a product of an exponential, so I'm going to move that product into a sum inside the argument of the exponential, and then combine it with this guy. So there should be another bracket. Yep. Okay. So this is now n on 2, because we've got a product of all of these guys. And then sum inside the argument. Okay, so this thing is a discrete approximation to a path integral over all of the points. The particle passing through all of the points Q. And again, we can write this in a nice compact form. In terms of the action, as Tom pointed out before. And so this thing is known as the configuration space path integral. And again, it should be viewed as a shorthand for this expression in the limit where n goes to infinity. Okay, so we have like maybe 15 more minutes, and I wanted to cover a few examples of evaluating the propagator for the free particle and the harmonic oscillator. Especially for the harmonic oscillator, you get to learn a couple of little tricks. And I wanted to also talk about the classical limit, so how adding, how we get a classical path, how we get the result that a particle takes a path according to the classical action, even though in this case we see that it's a sum over all of the different paths. But we're not going to get to do that here. So I think I'll just do the free particle, and then I was planning to do some stuff relating to the harmonic oscillator in the tutorial anyway, so maybe we can just work through it in detail in the tutorial.
You still have about half an hour.
Yeah, so, but there's supposed to be 1 hour 15, right? But I mean, if you guys don't mind staying till 12, we can like go all the way till 12.
What are we gonna do last week?
I don't know, like, no, I'm very happy to go until 12. So if you guys don't mind, like, that's fine. So yeah, then we can cover all the material. Excellent. Okay, free particle. So for the free particle, the potential is zero. So we just have the Hamiltonian H equals P squared on 2m. OK, and so first I'm going to hang on. Do I want to make some comments about the other thing? No, OK. No. Yeah, first I'm going to show you how to do it just quantum mechanically. And you'll see that it's much easier than in the path integral formalism, but that's okay. Yeah, that kind of ties, yeah. So at the beginning of the lecture, I had a few more things that I wanted to say as part of motivation. So maybe I can, yeah, just skip back and say them again, or say them at this point. If you remember, I was talking about that the path integral formalism was just a new third formalism for quantum mechanics. And I guess you could have asked the question, why are we interested in studying this formalism? Because as we're going to see in the upcoming examples, things are a lot more difficult. Like, so pretty much every quantum mechanical calculation that you do is more difficult using the path integral formalism than just using the original formalism. But as you're going to find out in the upcoming quantum field theory lectures, it turns out to be a very useful technique when studying quantum field theory. So even though in just standard quantum mechanics it's not that helpful, it's good for field theories. And then the other thing is, if you have a look at Feynman's original paper, which I have a reference to in the lecture notes, he's got this as part of his motivation. He has this nice quote where he says that there is a pleasure in recognizing old things from a new point of view. And so, I mean, that's another nice way to motivate it. But again, here we're going to see that it's like way more complicated using this formalism. Okay, so let's start. We have the free particle Hamiltonian. And so using standard quantum mechanics. We have that K is equal to the inner product of the final state, inner product of the state we're interested in, and the final state. So now we just insert the expression for the Hamiltonian and insert the resolution of identity. Then we have, okay, so this is an operator, and it's going to act on this P eigenstate, so it'll just pull out the eigenvalue P. And so once we do that, hang on a sec. No, something seems weird. Okay, no. So first we can move this integral out here because it's acting only on the, yeah, it kind of seems weird. But anyway, let's go with it. So we're going to move this integral out here, and it doesn't interfere with this operator. But then once we act the operator on P, then the eigenvalue is going to be inside the integral. Okay. and then using our expression for how to evaluate these inner products, which we've got up there, we can rewrite this as. An integral just over an exponential. Where this exponential has a Gaussian form, so we have just another Gaussian integral. And so we can use our solution to the Gaussian integral to rewrite this as follows. Okay, so that's the quantum mechanical result. And now let's do it using path integrals. So we'll write down the definition of the configuration space path integral. Yes.
What's on the bottom? You've got M over 2 something pi.
No, I'm sorry. My writing's terrible. Okay. So configuration space path integral is defined as the limit where n goes to infinity. Coefficient at the front, and then an integral over Q. Okay, so these, again, are just Gaussian integrals, and they can be evaluated exactly. But you can see that they're coupled because, let's say, if we were to expand this product, you would have a term that's like Q2 minus Q1, and then the one next to it would be Q3 minus Q2. So you have a bunch of different Gaussians where the same variable appears in different Gaussians next to each other. So that's much more tricky to evaluate, and so I won't do that here. We'll do it in the tutorial, but I'll write down the solution. So, I mean, you will do it in the tutorial. So it's going to be equal to something, well, to that. And okay, well, how about I just write it out? And then we realize that n times delta is just the total time. So nd equals capital T. And then we have And so, I mean, it looks like we did less work, but really there was quite a lot involved in actually solving this set of coupled, these coupled Gaussian integrals. But we can still arrive at the same solution. And you may notice that this here is the action for the for a free particle.
How do you get one solution squared?
Probably a typo. Hang on, where? Yeah. So I'm gonna guess. I think there has. Does anyone remember? I think the action's got a squared, right? Yes, the typo is there. And because we've got a Gaussian here and we integrate over it, we would expect to get a Gaussian at the end. Okay, great. And let's quickly just do a harmonic oscillator. Okay, so again, we're going to start with the configuration space path integral, but we'll do it, write down the formal definition first. So we have K is equal to integral over this derivative over the functions QT, and then the action. And for a simple harmonic oscillator, the action is given by this expression. Okay, and so then the method that we're going to use here is to suppose that we already know the solution to the classical action, and then we're going to use that to find out what the solution is for the quantum mechanical case. So let's suppose we already know the solution. The solution for the classical path, which we'll call Q subscript C. So that means that we've solved the following set of equations. So this comes from the equation of motions. And then we've got the boundary conditions. Where the particle first begins at Q and ends at position Q prime. And so that's just a classical problem. And then what we're going to do is we're going to write down that the quantum mechanical path is going to be equal to the classical path plus some deviation from the classical path. And now instead of integrating all possible paths, we're going to integrate all deviations from some classical path that we know the solution to. So using this, we can rewrite the action So now S of Q of T is going to be equal to S of Q classical plus the deviation. And so what we do here is we take this and insert it into this expression here. Yeah, so we insert the q's into the expression here, and then you're going to have a bunch of a product of this term, and so you'll find that you'll get terms that are quadratic in q, quadratic in y, and then you'll have terms that are linear in both of these. So we can rewrite this as an integral over terms that only depend on the classical action. So I'll let you stare at that for a little while, just to convince yourself that it's true. Okay, convinced. And so now what we're going to use is the fact that, so essentially, I mean, this is a power series of the classical action about, well, this, the classical point. And because we know that the, like, even though we haven't, well, we don't necessarily need to know the solutions to the classical action yet, but we know that the classical action is the one that minimizes, the classical path is the one that minimizes the classical action. And so if you have a minimum and you do a, you know, Taylor expansion about the minimum, you're not going to have any linear terms. Those terms have to be equal to zero. And so by construction, we know that these things are equal to zero. And if that's not obvious to you, it's like, just go have a think about it after the lecture, because it's kind of neat. Okay, so now we can just rewrite this as a term that's the classical action plus a term that's the action for this deviation, y. And now we can insert that into here and rewrite the propagator as a term that depends just on the classical action, and then a term that depends just on the deviations. Okay, and so we can just solve the classical bit using classical Lagrangian and the boundary conditions, and we get that S for the classical path is this. And to evaluate the path integral one, again, you need to use a bunch of tricks, which we may cover in one of the tutorials. And so we get the solution that okay, and you can see that it's kind of the same theme as with the free particle. That we have a term that separates into the classical action and then a term that depends on solving the quantum mechanical path integral. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about these two examples. And I guess, yeah, and like the last 5 minutes, let's just see if we can quickly cover this classical limit. Okay, so this is again the configuration space path integral. And let's like just look at it for a little while, right? Because so what this tells us is that the particle takes all paths, all possible paths between point A and point B. And like, I know you've probably heard this like lots of times, but it's like really weird. Like if you just like sit down and think about the fact that like a particle is doing that, it's like a totally weird thing. But you might be able to like reconcile this, like if you like reconcile this with what we expect classically. If you think, well, maybe you know the paths that are close to the classical path contribute, you know, are more highly weighted than all of the other paths, you know, then that might like satisfy you a little bit more. But then if you actually look at it, I mean, all paths are contributing equally. Like there's no coefficient at the front. This is all of them are just a phase, you know, on the on the unit circle. And so, like, how do we actually get classical physics out of, you know, this quantum mechanical expression? But we can do it. And so I'm going to kind of sketch out the way that you can motivate this. Okay, so let's just consider two neighboring paths. So we've got QT and Q prime T, which is a small deviation from QT. So here eta T is going to be small. And then because eta T is small, we can take a functional Taylor expansion about the classical path. Now, I don't believe this is obvious. I think you need to do some integration side paths to get to that point, but I haven't actually sat down and done it yet. But it's, I think it's worthwhile doing that. Okay, and so now if we're taking two neighboring paths, then the contribution to the path integral is going to be sum of those two paths. So we're going to have a term that's this phase for Q, and then this phase also for Q prime. So we get so the sum of the two paths. The amplitude for that will be approximately given by one path. Where we're neglecting corrections of order eta squared. And so you can see here, I mean, this is going to be a term that's e to the i zero. And then here we've got a term that's e to the I all of this stuff. So all of this stuff represents the phase difference between the two terms. And we can see that the smaller that this term is, or the smaller that h bar is, the closer the paths are going to be together. And if the phase difference is large, then we're going to have destructive interference between the paths. And if the phase difference is small, then we're going to have constructive interference. So let me just make sure I get this exactly right. Right, and so even if I said that, like, if the phase difference is small, we're going to have constructive interference. But even if the phase difference is, if the two paths are really, really close together, if h bar is sufficiently small, then you'll get constructive interference even for close paths. And, you know, quantum mechanically, h bar is a very small number. So we find that, you know, all of the neighboring paths are going to interfere. And so you would expect that you're going to get destructive interference everywhere. But we kind of have to reevaluate this argument about the classical path. So let's just do that. So the classical path we know is the one that where the action is minimized. And so in that case, as I mentioned earlier, when you have something that's a minimum and you do a Taylor expansion, there's no linear term. So if we were to do the same expansion around, so here we just did it about an arbitrary path, but if we were to do it around the classical path, then we would have S of Q classical plus some deviation is going to be equal to the classical action plus things of order eta squared. And so in this case, the actions are going to differ by much less for two randomly chosen paths around the classical path. And so, right. And so for a fixed value of h, which is what we have quantum mechanically, paths that are close to the classical path are going to, on average, interfere constructively, while everywhere else we're going to have paths that interfere destructively. So even though the phases, sorry, the amplitudes in front of all of these phases were equal, using like this argument, you can convince yourself that in the end, especially when, you know, in the classical limit where h bar is much smaller than the action of the system that we're looking at, in that limit, all you're going to be left with is just the classical path. That wasn't entirely clear, but hopefully that's made sense. So yeah, I guess I'll finish on that. But like, if yeah, if that isn't clear, maybe like we can try and I can try and re-articulate it again. But if not, okay, let's go to lunch.